Hey there, Elizabeth.
Hey, Sheila. So we've been friends for what, nearly 14 years now?
I think about that. Yeah, although we've been really good friends for about half of that, but that's kind of a part of our story, isn't it?
It is. Well, at least for now, we're really good friends in large part because we've learned to be honest with each other. But it's not always perfect. Nevertheless, we're learning a lot by being imperfectly honest and thought you might too.
The Imperfectly Honest podcast is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only. This podcast does not provide medical advice and is not intended as a substitute for the diagnosis and treatment provided by a licensed, trained physician, psychotherapist, or other health professional. This podcast expresses the individual opinions of Elizabeth, Sheila, and their guests and does not constitute professional medical or mental health services. In sharing their experiences, names, places, and other identifying information may be changed to protect the privacy of the people involved. There, Elizabeth.
Hey Sheila, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. So, in this episode, we're going to do something a little bit different. I interviewed a couple whose relationship I most admire. They are both romantic partners and business partners and have worked together for decades. I had the opportunity to work with them when I was in my early 20s, and I learned that relationships and work don't have to feel hard. And I wanted to revisit that conversation at a time when I have a blank slate, both with my love life and also with my work life. And just to give you a little bit of context for Michaela and Philip has been an artist for his entire life. Michaela has had many career iterations, but she feels that they have all led to what she's doing now, which is transforming the education system. And one of the things that I admire about them is that they are insatiably curious people who get interested in various issues and topics. And when something really lights them up, they just figure out how to create a project and get paid for that project to allow them to explore that issue and to do something that they actually care about. And I shared the recording of this interview with Sheila, and she had some really good insight. And so we wanted to just start this podcast with a few of her thoughts as well.
Thank you. I really appreciated you sending it to me, and I agree they are extremely interesting people, and I very much enjoyed listening to their perspectives. I guess my takeaway, I was more leaning into when they were talking about the journey of their relationship. And the first thing I found interesting was that they actually got together after a few decades of exploring other relationships. I mean, I think Philip was even, he may have mentioned he was married, and Michaela mentioned kind of creating lists of who she wanted to be with, and then finally getting to a point where I think she said she burned it after a while, and then she met Philip. And I love that part, that they kind of came together at a time that maybe it was the best for them. This is like a little snippet, a little teaser, a little trailer for the conversation to come. The part I really couldn't stop thinking about after I listened was they talked about how relationships, patterns of people that they've developed since childhood can really sometimes circumvent relationships. And they had a process where they feel it worked for them about how to let go of those patterns in order to maybe help the success of the relationship. And she listed a few things. And the first was having trust. The second was that it be right timing for both people to let go of those patterns. And the third was you have to be tired of those patterns, which I guess goes along with the second, the right timing for both to let go of those patterns. And the right timing, I guess, also the place in your life to meet this person. And then the final thing, I don't know if it was a part of those three things, but she also mentioned having a support system of other people that you can access in this process to help, to give insights. And really, that was fascinating for me to think about and kind of seems okay that, that's intuitive, like really, but I don't know that most of us really think that through when we're in relationships. So I guess I have to say, if there was a part of that interview that I enjoyed the most, it was that. But it was all very engaging and good to listen to.
Well, I agree 100%. And thank you for sharing those thoughts because I think it'll help people watch for things to listen especially closely to. And without further ado, here's the interview.
Michaela and Philip, thank you for joining us today.
Our great
Thank
pleasure.
you. So, do you want to just maybe take a quick minute to explain who you are and any context that you think might be helpful for this conversation?
I would say I've had multiple careers in my life. So when I was in college, I started off in public policy and doing research, and then got more into doing personal growth trainings. And that was around the time I met Philip. And I've never tried to make anything happen. It's always sort of fallen into my lap, each of these steps. And then people who were taking our seminars tended to be in corporations. And so they invited us to work in corporations. So we got asked to work at Coca-Cola and Steelcase and Boeing and Best Buy. And they were all people who came out of, well, in the beginning, they came out of these personal growth seminars. And now I'm in the career that excites me the most, which is trying to transform or think about how we can transform education and prepare young people for what I think is going to be a very different future. And we're still using old models for getting there. And the kids know it, they feel it. So in some ways, I feel like the most exciting part of my career is right now. It sort of builds on everything I've done before. And then Philip and I have gone, most of the time in our relationship, we've worked together. But it's interesting now, the last 8 years, for the first time, we're doing separate things. So you want to jump in, Philip?
Sure. Well, I, for my entire life, starting at the age of 5 or 6, have been a visual artist. With other ingredients into the mix, like Michaela just described, we were working together doing seminars for quite some time. During that period, I was painting, but having the luxury of just being in my studio, I have a beautiful studio here where we live. And being there every day and creating a kind of a progression in my work that I think didn't exist before. It was all broken up. Now it's a constant, continuous evolution of my process. We live in a mountainous area of Colorado where there's lots of creeks. And so that's a big part of my life. When the weather is right in the spring and summer and fall, where I go to the creeks and paint. Although, and we'll talk more about this a little bit later as an answer to one of your questions, but it's more and more apparent that our connection as a couple doesn't depend on being in the same place at the same time. We can be apart as we are all day, 600 feet apart. My studio from the house. And generally, more and more, what we each do is, when we compare notes at the end of the day, we can see that we're having a similar kind of a day. So that's kind of gratifying and sometimes funny. I think I'm celebrating life and everything that matters to me more than ever before, and each day that gets deeper. So I feel like I'm in a good place.
Do you feel like you had to overcome some sort of fear or limiting beliefs to live this life that you've lived?
For me, it was letting go of pictures. So that was the most important breakthrough. I mean, it was in both. So in terms of, when I was single and trying to find somebody, I don't know if that happens now, but it was popular at that time to write exactly what you wanted in your mate. And several times I found somebody who was exactly what I wrote up. And the timeline got shorter and shorter. You know, what used to be a 6 month relationship became a 3 month, became, and then it got down to a day. You know, I had to find somebody who was exactly what who I thought I wanted, and it would last a day. And so I remember I actually burnt the list, and I said, I'm just going to give up. I mean, I like myself. I'm happy to be alone, and that's what I'm going to do. And when I met Philip, I didn't have any of these feelings that I've had in the past. Does he like me? Am I pretty enough? Did I say the right thing? I was just completely the way I am now. I mean, I was exactly the same as I am now. And I felt sort of fearless. And the way we ended up, you know, we never planned anything in our relationship. But one day we were at a friend's wedding after we'd been together about 2 years, and we just felt safe. We felt creative. We were having a lot of fun. And it was a very romantic proposal. He pointed to the marriage and he says, "I think we should do that." And I said, "Yeah, okay." You know, that was so for me, it was just, I think when you have the pictures, it can be a setup to fail or to put pressure on something and not see what's in front of you.
Could you repeat the question, Elizabeth?
Well, I'm just curious if either in your relationship or just in carving out the life that you wanted to live, did you have to overcome some sort of a fear or a limiting belief to be able to really lean into that life?
I don't really know the answer to that because I know I've overcome lots of fears about myself and relationships. And I think by being in a succession, I was in a marriage for 15 years in Greece, married to a person who was Greek. And I had overcome a lot in that setting because I had learned to speak the language. I had to learn what was okay and what was not okay in that culture, and so on and so forth. So I had all the fears and hesitations that I had, I overcame during that period because it was testing me to the limit. And I didn't really have anyone who's, close to me, like an American friend, to talk it over with or compare notes or anything. I was kind of on my own in that respect. So I think the major fears and hesitations and so on that I had, I was able to work through during that period. I didn't know that's what I was doing, but looking back, I can see that's what I was doing. And so all that, I think, led up to that moment when our eyes met at an event we were both at, and I knew that was it. It was no question, no fear, no nothing. That was it.
And I thought he was totally obnoxious, was my first thought about.
Which I was.
I feel like you guys had such a marked impact on me, both because you just sort of taught me that life didn't have to be hard. I think I just always had this belief that to live the life that I wanted, I had to jump through all of these hoops so that maybe someday at the age of 65, I could enjoy life. And I feel like you guys just showed me that you could do work that you really loved, that maybe didn't even feel like work because you loved it so much, and you could make money, and you could have a life that didn't feel like a hamster on a hamster wheel. I don't know. I guess maybe to sort of parse that part of it out, I'm curious about maybe what you had to overcome to believe that you could find meaningful work that wouldn't cause you to run yourself into the ground like the average American 9-to-5-er.
I could jump in and say that what comes up for me when you ask that question comes up large is the fact that since I was like in my mid 20s, thanks to my dad, I've been a meditator. And I attribute a lot of the solutions and the sort of unfolding of my life in the present to that discipline of, for 20 minutes or half an hour each morning, going to that space that's, a non-space where you can let go, you can not be concerned with details or what's going to happen in an hour or whatever. I think that aspect of my life looms larger and larger because that space of meditation has gradually spread to everything I do. Sometimes people say, well, just take a breath. That's really it. Take a breath and let go. And for someone who, is not familiar with that process of meditation, that might seem a little scary, but it seems to me, like the most natural thing in the world.
And what came up for me was I think my grandmother has had probably the biggest impact on me in terms of shaping my sense of what's possible. And, like so many people, she came over Ellis Island. She was 16 years old, didn't speak the language, didn't have her family with her. And, like so many people of that time, or, immigrants, she went to work in the sweatshops, because she could figure out how to do a, run a sewing machine. And it was around the time that the whole labor movement was starting to brew. The railroad workers, the coal miners, everybody was starting to go, this isn't working for us. And she was a founding member of the Lady Garment Workers Union. And so when I think about it, at that time, people just, they were inventing something that didn't exist. And they were just making stuff up. And I also think my grandmother may have invented the first timeshare, because once they got the labor union established, then, they were working on, they now had 2 weeks of vacation, but they didn't have, still didn't have enough money to go do anything with that 2 weeks vacation. So she got everybody, I don't know what the number was, I'm going to say $50. She got everybody to chip in $50. She bought some land up in the Catskills. And everybody, and she created this, she didn't have a spreadsheet, but the equivalent of a spreadsheet. Everybody signed up for the 2 weeks that they wanted to do. And they slowly built these stone cabins over the course of several summers. And everybody had a summer home. She just said, I'm going to make this happen. But also that whole spirit of that time of people just making stuff up, that, creating new social forms. And I guess I'm really feeling that call right now with our current politics, is that we're going to have to jump levels. It's not going to be enough to go, wherever you are on that political spectrum, but we're going to have to make something up that's radically different. So I get excited when I feel a call. I don't know if that answered your question, but I don't know. I guess I've always been driven by creativity, and so that's always been stronger than my fears, and so often when I jump into something, the second thought I have after I say yes is, oh my God, what did I just do? And so then fear follows. But I always say yes, fear. And then the fear follows.
That's good.
I love that you're more driven by your creativity than your fear. And I've also had the experience that I've gotten so excited about something and said yes, and then just thought like, oh my gosh, how am I actually going to pull this off? And it's amazing how sometimes when you are so excited about something, something that would seem completely impossible becomes possible.
Yeah, and when it starts to become possible, I think that's where you have to watch the moment. Or is it starting to get formulaic, or are you still keeping it fresh? Depending, I mean, everybody has to know themselves, and everybody has a different tolerance for how much creativity they want in their life and how much certainty they want. But, I tend to be pretty high on the spectrum of wanting a lot of creativity. But you have to watch, when it gets, I don't know, that you stay true to that call and you keep following, because otherwise you get it. And the same with a relationship is, when it get if it's comfortable, it's comfortable, there can be a tendency to go, Oh, well, we don't have to do anything. We're cool. You know, we can just cruise from here on in. And we could, you know, we're not, even if one or another of us does something, we're not going to leave. We're too far down the road. We're not going to leave each other. But that's not fun either. You know, so I think to always have that desire to take your relationship to a new level, however good it is, and take that career choice to a new level, however good it is, or that emptiness to a new level, however good it is.
So, in addition to you showing me that life doesn't have to be hard and that you can find meaningful work that won't drive you into the ground, I also just really appreciated the opportunity to see how you guys work together and also had a romantic partnership. And so I'm curious from that perspective, what's been the biggest challenge about actually working with your spouse?
Well, for me, I think we would have been divorced if we weren't working together because my career is so much a part of who I am that I would either have had to have a spouse who was willing to endlessly listen to me talk about what I'm doing or have somebody co-involved with it, which just that seems like a more efficient way to do it. So for me, you know, because I care about both so deeply, having them merged is like the perfect situation for me. But, you know, that's not, again, that's not for everybody. But, you know, I always look if, to my, what I started to study in school, you know, was anthropology. And I always looked to traditional cultures. And the truth is, people always work together with the person they were married to. You know, it's only a recent phenomena that people have gone off somewhere else to do something and then come home and the other person hasn't experienced what they did that day. So that's more the outlier.
I think that one of the great gifts in our relationship is the period what Michaela talked about, where we were both leading seminars together all over the world. That could be, you know, a real test of a relationship because you're traveling, you might not have slept well, you have to leave this seminar in the morning, you don't know who's going to show up, you don't know what bumps in the road they're going to be in this seminar, and so on and so forth. And I think doing that for an extended period of time, for quite a few years, allowed each of us to traverse that territory of, oh my God, you know, what's gonna happen tomorrow? What if our plane is late? You know, all the things that come up when you're traveling and working together. And all the wonderful things that happen where, you know, somebody in the room has an aha moment and that kind of makes your day, makes your week, you know, that something clicked, something worked. And it's a joint experience of seeing that your work together is producing sometimes some great results, sometimes not so great. And then evaluating and saying, oh, when you said this, you know, I noticed that this person in the room, you know, we would kind of compare notes afterwards. You were about to say something, Michaela?
Well, I just thought of something. I think if you really love what you do, you know, it seems like such a gift to be able to share it with somebody you love because it just makes both better. But I was just thinking this is the first time I'm doing something different than Philip. I mean, he's still painting, but now he's doing it all the time. And I'm at schools 4 days out of the week, most often, from 8 to 3, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So the way we connect is each of us share, there's an hour drive each way. So this is why we're not listening to podcasts. Sorry, Elizabeth, but since we're on the phone for an hour in the morning and an hour as we're driving home. And we're both babbling, me more babbling than him, but we're both, you know, just kind of debriefing our day because we're so used to being immersed in each other's creative process. So it's interesting. We've both become storytellers, I think.
And we're both doing something that is, to a large degree, unpredictable. You never know how the kids are going to react to what you're saying, you know, or what's going to happen in a room full of 12-year-olds or whatever. And I have the same
15.
situation, 15-year-olds, and I have the same situation when I go to my studio. each day, I have no idea what's going to happen. It's just like a blank slate. And I sometimes there's a lot of fear. Sometimes there's a lot of excitement, usually excitement, because, I don't know until I pick up the brush and start making marks. So I think being able to compare notes the way Michaela just described is what were you about to say?
It was sort of a tangent, so wait, I'll do it. Because when I corrected you about the age, and I said it's because I'm working more with 15, 16-year-olds, 17, that age group, and that's like the most nerve-wracking time of life. You're just so self-conscious, and when you're talking about fears and things getting in the way, I mean, you're just a basket of that at that age. But in all cultures, that's also been the age of initiation. And I don't use that word when I talk to kids, and I don't say that. But I just the essence of what they're struggling with is that vision quest energy. Who am I? What's my first step? I don't know. It was less about our relationship and not about the question you asked, but just realizing how much I feel that energy right now, that vision quest. So I have finally found an age group I can relate to. I'm joking.
In the theme of this podcast, and perfectly honest, I've found that my best relationships have required some honest conversations, some of which have not been easy to have. Did you have to have some of those to be able to work together
All the time.
and to continue to thrive?
All the time. I mean, I think what we got better at is I think when you're in the early stages of a relationship and one person says, the way you said that made me feel like the other person takes it more personally. And so I think in the early stages of a relationship, it's more of, you're kind of working out your path, whatever was, your childhood patterns with each other. And, so, I mean, we're talking like everything's all cool, but there was a time where we were definitely working through that stuff too. I forgot about that stage. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that what happens is, at least for us, what got better was that when the other person was sharing, having those tough conversations, that the other person was able to just listen, was able to listen more deeply and not go, oh, it must be because I did something wrong or something right. It was less about ping pong and more about watching the other person go through their self, analysis and self-awareness. So I think that's what happened over time. In the beginning, it was like, I don't feel supported, and this is where it comes from. And there was all that analysis in the beginning. The other thing is because we were working with in a business where a lot of people were doing similar things, we got a lot of help. And I remember there was a book around that time. I can't remember. I remember, I may be getting the title wrong, but it was written by a couple who were African. They came from a village where it was an arranged marriage. So, the elders would sit around and talk about who do you think should be with this one, and they put them together. But they said, once they got put together, that was the beginning of, that wasn't like the end of the story. And the whole book, I think the book was called It Takes a Village. And their whole thing that they used to talk about was it's very hard to do it alone. And that, especially at the beginning stages of relationship, we don't have, we may have elders in our life or professional mentors, but it's almost like we need couples mentors too. We need couples elders who, and so we had that. And I think that helped a lot. We had people model healthy communication, and we had people sit with us when we both hated each other and we wanted to give up and all those moments. So it's hard to, I think it's hard to do it alone without, and and I'm not sure therapy does it. It's almost like you need kind of that blend of a friendship, something that's a little bit more organic. would make life easier for a lot of couples, especially in the early stages.
And you know, it was a huge gift that what we were teaching in these early seminars before the corporate work was personal growth. And that required each of us to recognize and move through our patterns of behavior that we had developed as kids, to recognize them, to see them come up, to move through them, to talk about them. That was a huge gift, because those patterns are, you know, deeply ingrained. They started maybe when you were 2 years old or 5 years old, and for the most part, they're relationship patterns of how you relate to the world, how you relate to the person you're in love with, and how you relate to yourself.
That reminds me of something that you told me once, which is that couples typically know the three fights that they're going to have throughout their relationship within the first or second date. And yeah. I'm curious if you still believe that, and if that's played out for you, and if you have any thoughts that you could expand upon with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if it's exactly three, but I think you tend to have one or two really dominant things that just keep repeating. And then, you know, if you're, you can usually track it back to your early childhood, to your relationship with your parents. And then, you know, usually it fits with the other person's pattern. So if you feel like the other person's hearing you, and maybe your parents didn't really, you felt like your parents didn't really get who you are and didn't really listen. And so then, you know, maybe, I mean, this wasn't exactly our thing, but, and then if the other person feels like their, you know, their mother pushed them or their parents pushed them. So then when one person says, you're not listening to me, then the other person experiences as, you're pushing me to be something different. And then you just do, maybe I said three at that time, I would reduce it to one at this point. You tend to have one core, maybe a side tangent, but a few side tangents. But I think you just, you know, it tends to be that primal, you know, we all have like this primal wound that, and then you find somebody whose primal wound kind of matches you. And that's, you know, where the magic is. If you can see that interlocking pattern and kind of slowly start to unravel it, then that's the magic of a relationship, that it can allow you to grow in a way that's harder to grow alone. But, you know, and like you said, you know, tough conversations, you know, I remember one time, I guess we were in Palm Springs at some hot spring or something, and I got so mad at him. The same argument that we'd had a gazillion times already, that I got in the car, I took the car, he was in the hot springs, and I drove for like 3 hours. I just left him there. And at a certain point, I went, where are you going? You know, I'm driving in the desert. And, you know, and I was just certain I never want to see him again, ever. And, you know, I'm driving, you know, on this desert road further and further, and I'm going, where are you going? There's nowhere to go. And I turned around and I came back, and when he saw me, he just laughed and he said, I knew you'd come back. And I don't know, he kind of popped the bubble on that core, and I don't even remember what it was, but I don't think we ever had that same fight at that level ever again. I mean, it kind of, that was like the crescendo of, this is not going to work, I have to leave.
You know, what's occurring to me as I'm listening to you is that I spent a fair amount of time with you when we were working together, and I can't think of a single time that I felt that the two of you were arguing. And I remember thinking how unusual that was for me, because I had never been around couples that operated like that. And I think, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I imagine that you got to that point in part because of working through the arguments that you had in your early relationship. But I imagine that there were arguments that I didn't see and that you weren't hiding. It's just they weren't as frequent as some of the relationships that I had experienced. And I don't know, I guess maybe what I'm hoping to find is someone who's willing to do the hard work at the beginning and to keep doing that work, because I imagine that never stops.
Yeah. You know, everybody has a different style. Neither of us are yellers. So I don't think we ever had the kind of arguments you would think about, you know, with one person yelling at the other and just going, yeah. I'm not sure I know how to yell. And I've never heard Philip yell. So that helped a lot, is that when we did have these discussions that were, you're a terrible person and I have to leave, at least we talked about it in a quiet fashion. It does help to lower the temperature, I will say, you know, and again, it depends on, again, that we all have different wiring from our family. I had like a very intellectual, quiet family. And but he had a mother who screamed. And so if I even raise my voice, he sees it as screaming in the past. You know? So he was so sensitive to have, you know, his mother would go into these rages. So I don't know. I mean, every couple's different, but yeah, well,
I married a woman who did the same thing.
Was a screamer for sure. Screamer. And she was very comfortable and more of a leaver, you know, like I just quietly leave, which that was no big deal for him. He was pretty relaxed about it, which I wasn't a screamer. So that's, you know, would have been tough for him. I know you asked this question early on and we probably didn't go straight for it, but yeah, I think there's sort of like, you could call it like a death urge of every relationship. It's where your patterns come together and you go, it just can't work. You know, it'll be good for a while, but something might come up and it's just not going to work. And if there's enough trust in the relationship, and if it's the right timing for both people and they're tired of their patterns, then you'll get through it. And then if you happen to have some people around you who can kind of act as a support system, that really helps too. It's really hard to do it alone, I think, in the early stages of a relationship.
Are there any ways in which your relationship is different from a working together business perspective versus your romantic relationship?
Not a lot. I mean, in that we both, when something's not working in our relationship, we talk about it. In our work relationship, if we feel something's not working, we talk about it. And I just think what we've both gotten better at over the decades now is when one person's going through something, the other person is able to just listen and be quiet and let them do what they need to do. So I think we do that in our relationship and in our work when we're working together.
See, and I think the most important thing you just said for me was just listen. That is, I think, missing from a lot of relationships, just listening. It seems like the simplest thing, but it's not. I mean, it is for me now, you know, but it's sort of the key to everything. Just listen.
And it's sort of a stereotype, but I think men in our culture, a little bit more than women, think they have to fix things. So if a woman says, I don't feel like you're really listening to me, they go, well, but, you know, they feel they have to fix it. And so it's really hard for, you know, I think Philip's years as a meditator, he's just really good at not fixing stuff. And he's also good at I think it's a combination of not, when the other person's going through something, don't feel like it's your job to fix it. It's their choice to fix it. And the more you can just be there and be a safe place and reflect back to them, the easier it is for them to be able to fix it. The other thing I think Philip was particularly good at is I'm good at just swallowing my feelings and just going, I'm fine, I'll go to work. you know, and so he was also good about saying, I think you need to say more about that. And then he modeled that for me, and I got better at doing that for him, saying, I think you need to say more about that. I don't think you're finished with that, or can you go deeper with that? And so I think that combination of like not trying to fix the other person, but also encouraging them to take it further.
And then sort of side by side, I think, you know, listening is the key word, but also acknowledgement, but not just acknowledgement for the sake of acknowledgement, but genuine. That was great what you just did. That was beautiful what you just said. You know, sometimes you feel that and you don't express it. And just think for yourself how important that is when somebody acknowledges you for something that you just said or did, even if it was not recent. You know, it's still an extremely important part of relationships, I think. You know,
I mean, I would take it even deeper than acknowledgement. It's like genuinely enjoying the way some, you know, seeing them as a work of art, and you know, in the same way you might enjoy a painting. When the other person says something interesting, you go, that was cool. Can you take it further?
And so more and more I'm seeing, you know, relationships in general, but our relationship specifically, as, you know, we've talked about this recently with Michaela, as music. You know, what's the music in this? I have that experience when I'm painting. You know, it's like a musical experience where there are tones that are lighter and that are, you know, there are ones that make you cry. There are ones that get you very excited and want to get up and dance. You know, it's all music. And I think the music of a relationship is always shifting.
Yeah, we get very dialogue-based and very linear sometimes. And if we can stay more in the music of what's happening with another person, I mean, that's what any interesting, you know, we haven't asked you any questions, Elizabeth.
Yeah, really.
What's going on? What's happening?
I've engineered it that way. No, I love talking about myself, so I'm happy to share anything. But
So how's all this sitting with you, or what question, you know, what personal questions do you have?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the main reason why I was excited to talk to you about this is that I have this opportunity in which I basically have a blank slate. I'm winding down the career that I've had since 2015, and I'm recently divorced, and I'm having this opportunity to just really think broadly about what's possible for my future. And I want that future to include the pursuit of meaningful work that actually makes a difference and that doesn't feel like work because I'm so inspired about it. And I don't necessarily feel that this is a requirement, but I do feel like it's a desire to work with a partner in a relationship somewhat similar to what you guys have, that doesn't have boundaries around work and the personal relationship. I guess I was just kind of curious to hear more about what worked and didn't work and your journey in that. And one other thing that we haven't touched on much that I've been thinking about a lot is the masculine and feminine qualities that make a relationship work. I'm curious if you guys have thought much or worked through traditional feminine and masculine roles in relationships and how that's played out for you.
I'm too aware of seeing it that way for myself, just because I've always, you know, maybe sort of like you, I've always been pretty ambitious and my work has always been important to me. And also I've never even been mildly attracted to men who I felt were very dominating. Even the relationships that didn't work, I think I was always with men who had a strong emotional component.
Mm.
So I don't know. I don't see it so much as male female personally, but I do think, however you put that together, I think that if both people have a strong emotional component, so I think Philip and I have always both been committed to growing emotionally, and we've also been committed to growing professionally. So I think you can have both. And I think one without the other would have felt empty to me. I could have had the greatest career in the world, but if I didn't have someone to share it with, nurturing it wouldn't, I mean, Philip and I have often talked about this, that whenever either one of us have a success, small, big, medium, whatever it is, we go, the best part of it is being able to tell you about it. And it wouldn't be, because otherwise it's just like checking off the boxes on some scorecard or something. But when you share it, that's the best part of it, having someone to share about it.
Interestingly, what that brought up for me, I was trying to think masculine, feminine. I don't really think that way, but a short story is that every morning, this has sort of been building over a number of years.
Am I going to get embarrassed now or what? No, I'm teasing.
No, I make Michaela's coffee.
Okay.
And for me, that's more of an artistic process because I choose which beans I'm going to get. I roast the beans. It's a whole megillah that takes about an hour.
He's befriended a farmer in Yemen and they discussed the crops, and this is how far he's gone into
But my point is that when I bring her the, this is before I even start painting and going to my studio, I see this as it's not a masculine or a feminine thing. It's, again, it's a musical artistic thing where, maybe the combination of beans, every day is a different combination of beans. They're all from Yemen, but it's a different combination and a different dark roast or medium roast or whatever. And then, I wait to see the look on her face when she has the first sip. And for me, that's a huge start to my day, whether she loves it or thinks it's interesting or moderate or whatever. So I don't know what really this has to do with masculine and feminine, but maybe it's an example of how I don't think that way. I think of things as creativity and music. That's where it's at for me. And I understand, this difference between masculine, feminine. My dad was not one of these masculine figures. He was a CPA, and in his off time, he was a philosopher who was deeply interested in the Jewish mystical tradition. And so what I got from that was, was that a masculine thing? Was that a feminine thing? That was a Roy Tarlow thing. That's who he was. And that's what I got, was he did his work really well at his office in New York. And then he was going into these esoteric books on Jewish mysticism and wanted to talk with me about it. And so that's what I got. I didn't get from him, this is a masculine, this is my dad, he's a guy. I got that he was able to balance these two sides of himself beautifully. So I don't know why I started with the coffee, but that's
I have to give a shout out to Humani Coffee. Encourage people to drink as much of it because it's keeping the country afloat. It's the only income this country has right now. But it's really good coffee. But I have a question for you, Elizabeth. So there's parts of yourself you see as more masculine and others feminine that you can you say more about that?
I think part of the problem is that I'm trying to formulate it in my head, and I'm not totally sure how to explain it. But it's interesting that, Philip, that you brought up that example because it helped me sort of clarify some of my feelings. So I imagine you may have chosen that example because a traditional 1950s male would not have made their wife coffee because that was something that housewives were supposed to do for their husbands. And
I think that we are in this period now where we can choose to do what we want to do because it feels good or it's what we enjoy doing. And I'm just learning in this process that there's some things that are analogous to making coffee for my husband. So I never would have made coffee for my husband in the morning because I felt like that was succumbing to the role that was etched out for the 1950s housewife. And now I'm waking up every morning and making coffee for the man that I'm in a relationship with, not because I feel like I'm pressured to, or because society wants me to do that, but because I naturally wake up before him and it feels kind of nice to do something nice for him that he really appreciates first thing in the morning. And I never would have allowed myself to do that in the past.
Yeah.
And just one other example, I get a lot of anxiety about making stupid decisions, like whether we're going to go out to dinner or stay in for the night. It's silly, but I just sort of go in this spiral of weighing the pros and cons of each. And I'm in a relationship with somebody right now who will say, like, I think we should do this. And if I protest and say I don't want to do that, he's not going to force me to do it. And he's not going to be upset that I protest. But he just kind of is a more naturally dominant person and kind of likes making those decisions. And the old me never would have allowed somebody to make those decisions for me because, again, it was like I was succumbing to the template that I was supposed to be forced into as a 1950s housewife. And now I'm realizing that it's actually opening up a lot of space for me. It's more fun for me to think about bigger problems in the world to solve than whether we should go out to dinner or stay in.
That's fantastic. That's just fantastic. I mean, because if he likes making decisions, you got it. It's all yours.
Right.
One less thing you have to do.
And I guess part of the reason why I was curious about asking that question to you is that, you know, Michaela, I experience you to be a natural born leader who often sort of steps up first and leads meetings and things. And, you know, if you were a traditional 1950s couple, I'm not sure that Philip would be comfortable with you doing that all the time. I guess I'm just curious, like, if that ever caused friction in your relationship, or if you even ever thought about it that way, or any of those things.
I mean, I guess what I appreciate about Philip, you know, I had been with men in the past who were more threatened by that, and I felt like I had to tone it down. And Philip was never threatened by it, you know, sort of like you letting him make the, you know, he went, sure, you go first. Fine. I need time to think about what I want to say anyway. So I don't know. I don't think that's been one of the things we've had to work on. Mm. Yeah. For me, the bigger thing I had to work on was my family was very intellectual. Emotions were never talked about. Everything was calm, but there was definitely a lot of things that were not working and nobody ever talked about it. So I think for me, what Philip, you know, maybe the patience that he has and the space that he allowed, you know, he was the first person I was ever able to share deep emotions with and feel safe just because he gave me so much space. I think almost whether you want to call it masculine or feminine, but that receptive quality that he has allowed me to discover, you know, to share about my feelings at a level that I had never been able to do. It was a scary space for me, an unfamiliar space. So I guess, you know, and again, like you say, in the 50s model, I guess that's a little bit of a role reversal where the man is better with feelings and emotions. And to me, that was looked like incredible bravery and strength. So I don't know, you know, we have a choice how we want to label things.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, the word space, because increasingly, Michaela has given me very valuable feedback on paintings that I'm working on. And a lot of it has to do with space. Oh, I love that you left all this white space in this painting, you know, and it's something I might not have noticed or might not have registered with me if I didn't have that. So I think it's a good metaphor. It's a good space, you know, I mean, listening and space are two important words in a relationship, I think.
I'm not sure that I realized this until just now, but I actually think maybe the biggest gift that you guys gave me is being able to see a woman step up and be the first to speak and be in a leadership role, and to see a man that was not threatened by that. Because I also had the experience in past relationships that men that I really did want to be in a relationship were threatened by me. And I found myself toning myself down, which felt terrible. I did not want to be that person.
Yeah.
And so I just feel really grateful that I was able to see that, because I never felt like either of you were less than in your partnership. I felt like you provided totally unique and different perspective. And it's interesting because I felt like you each interjected at natural times. And I just had never seen that before in a relationship. I just really appreciated the opportunity to see that. And all of this, I think labeling things masculine and feminine can be a dangerous rabbit hole. And that allowing yourself, kind of like you said at the beginning, about just being willing to drop the picture is just so much easier than trying to conform yourself. You know, I've spent a lot of my life trying to fit my square peg self into a round hole.
Yeah. Well, it also allows for the possibility of unexpected, unprogrammed developments that couldn't have happened without that space, you know, without that lack of rigidity and planning. This is what comes next. This is how it's supposed to look. When you drop that, amazing things can happen, and they usually do. They're just waiting for that opportunity to show themselves to you. And if you're not giving them that opportunity, they just won't show up.
Well, is there anything that you feel that you haven't said that our audience absolutely needs to hear from you before we close this lovely conversation?
It was something you said earlier. I don't know if this is a good way to close it or not, but since you brought up investment, you know, and being good, being able to tell whether somebody was committed to something, I heard this interview. I can't remember who it is. You know, like if I could remember his name, you'd know who it was. You know, I think he was one of the early people for Google and stuff like that. And he was being interviewed, and what's your criteria for investing in something? And he says, well, the main thing I look for is, have they failed yet? And he says, I prefer businesses that have failed 3 times before I invest in them, because that way I know they know how to overcome obstacles and that they're still committed to it. And I thought it was just such an interesting concept. And so I think, you know, in a relationship, you know, part of what it takes too is, you know, seeing those times when it's not working as being really powerful moments of finding your commitment to the relationship.
That's good. And I would like to close my comments with the word I haven't used throughout this conversation, which is gratitude. So first of all, I'm grateful, Elizabeth, that you know, created this conversation. It's really been meant a lot to me. It's made me think, and I'm going to be thinking tonight and tomorrow all about what was said and what wasn't said. But I'm feeling increasingly gratitude for being alive, for being in a great relationship, for living in a beautiful house, for having a beautiful studio, and on and on and on. And I think that that gratitude just keeps growing. I wake up in the morning and I just feel grateful to be getting out of bed, But I also wanted to express my gratitude to you for creating this opportunity to talk about our relationships and hopefully give you some support.
It was wonderful to reconnect with you. And I remember all the reasons you really have stood out for me through all these decades since we first met. So I would love to continue.
Well, I am honored. Thank you. And it's kind of funny how people pop into your mind and into your life at different times. For me, especially recently, it's felt like there was some sort of intelligent design behind all of it. And when we worked together, I was in my early 20s, and I was in a very similar situation that I'm in now, actually, that I was just sort of starting to really grasp what my opportunities were. Well, I will listen and pay attention to anything you guys do. So please keep me in the loop. And yeah, until next time.
So now I'll put on my apron and cook dinner, which I do cook dinner. I love to cook dinner.
Well, and Philip can sit in a reclining chair with a cigar and some scotch and just bark orders at you as you're
Yeah,
doing
exactly. Exactly.
it.
Where's my dinner?
Right.
Get it ready now.
All right. Well, thank you for all of your time tonight and for decades of wisdom. And I really look forward to our next chat.
Same here. Okay. Bye.
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 The Imperfectly Honest podcast is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only. This podcast does not provide medical advice and is not intended as a substitute for the diagnosis and treatment provided by a licensed, trained physician, psychotherapist, or other health professional. Note that, notwithstanding that any of the guests on this podcast may be licensed professionals, no one on this podcast is providing or seeking to provide the listeners of this podcast with any medical or health services. You should not rely on the information or content presented during this podcast, and you should not make any health or medical related decision based in whole or in part on such information. Consult a healthcare professional licensed in your state for all matters relating to your health, and do not disregard any medical advice, diagnosis, and/or treatment provided by your healthcare professional. This podcast expresses the individual opinions of Elizabeth, Sheila, and their guests, and does not constitute professional medical or mental health services. In sharing their experiences, names, places, and other identifying information may be changed to protect the privacy of the people involved.